From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made with a headline that reads, quote, giant venomous flying spiders expected to invade Rochester. What you need to know, end quote. That is a headline that our team saw on Facebook from a local media source that was not WXXI, thank God. But let's clear something up. The large, brightly colored Joro spiders are making their way across the country, sure, but despite their rather alarming-sounding headline, experts say the spiders are really not all that dangerous to humans. They don't fly. They're not invading. It's not like there's an army of them that's like creating a battle plan, and they're like, let's do Western New York today. That is not what's happening here, and the headlines are a little alarming here. So we're going to try to be a little more responsible. Because at their worst, a little bit of what these spiders can do to you can cause like an itch or an allergic reaction, but they mostly avoid humans because they're shy. That information comes from NPR, which is trying to do a more responsible job than other media agencies. They spoke to Michigan State University entomology professor Hannah Burak, and Burak says the species is showy. It's getting a lot of attention, but we should be more worried about pests like fruit flies, tree borers. She says those are the pests that can do a lot of damage, and they are doing a lot of damage. And it seems that every year a new invasive species gets in the headlines. Murder hornets? They're not murdering. The spotted lanternfly? The LDD, which is now the spongy moth? The emerald ash borer? Those are just a few in recent years. And if you haven't encountered one of those, perhaps you've dealt with dandelions or stink bugs or zebra mussels, which are common in our region's parks, lakeshores, backyards. According to a report from the Intergovernmental Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, human activities have introduced more than 37,000 invasive species to different regions around the world. Those species affect human health, they affect ecosystems, the economy. According to the report, the global economic cost of invasive species was more than $423 billion annually in 2019. So what can we do? What is our role here? Not only to recognize, but maybe to stop this or to alert people who have expertise. Our guests this hour are going to help us explore many of these questions, and they'll help us identify what's going on here. And I would like to welcome our guests now. They have long and accomplished titles. Matt Gallo, Terrestrial Invasive Species Program Manager for the Finger Lakes Partnership for Regional Invasive Species Management at the Finger Lakes Institute at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. I close to stuck the landing there, Matt.
Yeah.
I tripped a little. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate having you here. Amy Slentz is here. Amy's an Aquatic Invasive Species Program Manager for PRISM, the Finger Lakes Partnership for the Regional Invasive Species Management at the Finger Lakes Institute at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Hi, Rochester.
And Whitney Carlton is just a natural resource steward biologist for the Finger Lakes, New York State, with New York State Parks. I say just. It's just a shorter title. It's great to have you. Thank you for being here.
Happy to be.
It's a weird day. You know, Matt walked in and was saying it's kind of timely with all of this hype about this spider. But it also feels kind of like a dumb time when I see some of these headlines. How do you feel seeing all these headlines about a flying spider that is invading?
I'm thankful that someone's paying more attention to invasive species. I think, you know, when we think about environmental issues that are affecting our planet today, like things that come to mind are usually pollution, you know, deforestation, places like the Amazon, climate change. And also, those are all really timely, important, very serious issues. But one thing that really tends to go under the radar for a lot of the damage that our environment is facing right now are invasive species. Now, Joro spiders, like you had said, like they're not really as big of a concern as the media hype is really making them up to me. They're really just gentle giants. They're just big spiders. They kind of stick to themselves and don't really cause any harm to our environment, our economy, or our own health. But I think they could be a good window for people to learn more about the wider world of invasive species out there.
I think that's well said. Are they in the category of invasive species?
So when we're thinking about what an invasive species is, we could probably spend all of the next hour trying to wrap our heads around what makes a particular species to be invasive. The quick and dirty way of thinking about it is that an invasive species is any organism. So this could be an animal, this could be a plant, could be a fungus, could be a virus, bacteria, any kind of living thing that is moved by humans from one place to another. And in the new place it's been moved to, it's causing some kind of harm. And that could be environmental harm, that could be economic harm, that could be harm to human health. It doesn't have to be doing all three of those things at the same time. It could just be causing environmental harm, just be causing economic harm. It could be causing a combination. It could be doing all three, but either way, it's something that's not native and it's harmful in some way.
And so the Joro is probably not?
Probably doesn't meet really.
Probably doesn't meet that standard.
Yeah. Yeah. So we would just consider it to be like a non-native species, but not an invasive species.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think mostly, Amy Slentz, it's that people are scared of spiders. Not me.
Not you. Right, not me either.
Okay. A little bit me. A little bit me. And, you know, they're sort of big looking and kind of to use a term that has no real specific applied meaning, but maybe they're kind of exotic looking. But has it been weird seeing all the hype about that when you're like, hey, we've been trying to get you to pay attention to all kinds of things here, as Matt said, and now you're fixated on this spider, which is kind of inconsequential.
Yeah, definitely. I think I like what Matt said about these spiders being an entry point for a lot of folks into the invasive species realm. So I'm focused on aquatics, as you introed, and in all of the species you listed, I only heard the zebra mussel there, but there are...
See, that's why you're here. I know there's a lot more than that one.
yeah, there's a number of organisms out there that are non-native, and folks do have a lot of impact in keeping our natural systems in balance, and they do have a lot of power when it comes to preserving our natural spaces.
I mean, if this spider could really fly, Whitney Carlton, then I think we'd probably still be fine. I think of it like somebody described it like a slightly like a cousin of a daddy long legs, which can't really bite you anyway. Like this thing isn't.
Mm-hmm. Smaller mouth parts. It's a classic case of to the charismatic goes the attention, right? So this is a really exotic looking spider, as you alluded to.
Yeah.
And the same issue happens on the level of endangered species. Things like tigers and lions are really getting a lot of attention. And there are things that are far more scarce, like, you know, maybe small insects or something like that, that maybe is where our attention should go, as you said, with emerald ash borer or spotted lanternfly or something. And spiders are something that scares us, and they're big and bright and colorful in this case. So,
mm-hmm. In a moment, I'm going to go through the list that we've talked with listeners about in recent years. And our guests will kind of describe, as far as they've seen, the state of it. And then they're going to have plenty of time to talk about what we are missing, because there's a long, much longer list, as Amy was saying, than just the zebra mussel in the water. But I hope this will be helpful for listeners, because our guests really believe that we all have a role here, and that this matters beyond just a zebra mussel will cut your foot if you step on it without a water shoe on, or, you know, the spongy moth is sort of annoying, if you know, as we saw a few years ago. It's bigger than that. We have a role. Some of it relates to the need for Amy Slentz biodiversity, yes?
Yeah, definitely. I was hoping to jump in there. I think I would really like to raise folks' understanding of what biodiversity means and why it's important, you know, moving forward in our existence on this planet, and really drive that home for folks.
Well, let's talk about that.
Okay, great.
I mean, biodiversity, I think, is the name is pretty self-evident.
Mm-hmm. Biological diversity.
But what the lay public probably doesn't understand is how threatened is our biodiversity,
mm-hmm.
and how concerned are you for the future of biodiversity?
Yeah. So if we think of biological diversity as the variety of species in an ecosystem, that creates a really well-balanced and therefore stable system. I'd like to think of it as like a Jenga tower. So a single block in a Jenga tower has multiple points of connection that supports the entire tower. But so taking that analogy one step further, if we remove a block from that tower, not only are we losing that incredibly unique species, but we're destabilizing the system. Now, expand that exponentially and you kind of degrade the whole system. It becomes super unstable, really not resilient. So invasive species kind of, instead of stacking the tower in a way that creates multiple points of connection, invasive species really act like just stacking blocks one on top of the other, you know, really tall, really high, completely an unstable structure. If we create unstable systems, things like climate change or these really intense climatic events like really threaten our natural world and the stability of our natural spaces.
My sense is that there is a feeling of inertia that, you know, we've grown up with beautiful parks, with beautiful natural resources, with reasonably clear skies, with volatile weather at times, but most often survivable, and with enough biodiversity that you know, the systems around us feel stable.
That's right.
And so it's easy just to assume that that will be the state of things going forward. It's hard to imagine what system collapse or, you know, a tremendous change, weather driven by climate change, lack of biodiversity, would look like. But how concerned are you about that?
I think fairly concerned.
Yeah.
Being out in the field and looking at a monoculture of an invasive species and thinking, this is a degraded habitat. This is a Jenga tower that's barely teetering. Thinking about the way our climate is already changing, right? We're seeing like longer growing seasons, warmer winters. I'm already seeing the impact that that has on aquatic habitats, for example, and what that jeopardizes for us.
And before anybody just assumes that, well, longer growing season is better, it's not one thing. It's not just better or worse. It's not a straight line. And if you work in growing, what you know is a longer growing season means more risk of losing entire crops due to, you know, whether it's early bud break or early bloom and then frost. I mean, there's a lot of risk and volatility baked into what a longer growing season would look like, especially one that seems, I was going to use the word unnaturally, I don't know if that's the right word, but for our region, when you extend it as much as we've seen in recent years, you talk to growers and they're not instantly happy about that. They're very worried about what that portends.
Yeah, it's uncomfortable for the native species in our region for those like climatic conditions to change like a longer growing season.
Matt, how concerned are you about biodiversity in the future?
Yeah, I'm really concerned about biodiversity because usually, you know, when we have invasive species moving in, like how Amy had mentioned earlier, they tend to form monocultures. And so, you know, when we're looking at my side of invasive species, the terrestrial, the land-based side of invasive species, you can go out into most forests in New York State right now. And you had mentioned before, Evan, that, you know, there's this sense of like inertia, you know, like, hey, we passed the Clean Air Act where, you know, we have clear skies, pollution's down, we've made all these parks and like things are getting better. And in a lot of ways, I don't want to like detract from any of that. Like we have made really great environmental
strides. Sure, those are important changes.
Mm-hmm. But you go out into a lot of local parks, you know, even like a lot of New York State parks. And if you don't know what you're looking at, it looks great because it's all green. There's all this plant life. There's bugs there. And it seems like it's a functioning ecosystem. But when you actually begin to understand what these different plant and animal and fungal species are that are out there, you'll see at a lot of, you know, even just like local parks here in Monroe County, there's no forest regeneration anymore. So we essentially have this this age class of really older trees that came in, you know, maybe about 100 years ago or so. And if you look at the understory, what we should have is lots of different ages of trees growing up in the understory to be that next generation of trees. We should see little saplings. We should see medium-sized trees. We don't really see that. And there's two main reasons for that. I mean, one is a overabundance of deer. They're kind of chewing everything down and not really allowing that regeneration to happen. But another big thing is invasive species, particularly invasive plant species, have moved in. And because deer aren't eating the invasive plant species are kind of running buck wild right now, and they are crowding out a lot of our native species.
What's an example of an invasive plant species?
There's several. There's many different honeysuckle species. There's multiflora rose. There's garlic mustard. There's swallowwort. There's autumn olive. There's bittersweet. There are tons and tons of different, and those are just the common ones.
And can we be sometimes confused because we might find them pleasing?
Yeah, definitely. You know, there are people who I've heard stories of. There's one really particular invasive plant species that causes a lot of human health impacts called giant hogweed. And right now, the state has a program where they're seeking to eliminate giant hogweed from essentially the entire state. And a lot of giant hogweed is found on private lands. And there are some places where they will try to remove giant hogweed. And DEC, you know, does this for free, pretty much. The landowner doesn't have to do anything. But, you know, because they have these bright white flowers, people like them. Even so, they don't want them to get rid of giant hogweed, even though if that giant hogweed is allowed to spread onto someone else's land, they might unwittingly come into contact with it and get severe sunburns because of it. So yeah, that's a really big thing we see with a lot of invasive species. And in fact, most of our invasive plant species were brought over as horticultural plants because they look really nice, mm-hmm. or they perform some kind of function or service to us. So
that's interesting. Whitney, how concerned are you about biodiversity in the future?
Well, my entire position is really based around it, so I suppose pretty concerned. The wonderful thing about working with the Finger Lakes Prism is that they have this great voice to the public, and I'm able to utilize that to make, as Matt mentioned, the work that we're doing in state parks seen, because it is very much like a green blindness. You know, you can have one environment that's not functioning as it should, and then when you completely restore that to an area that is teeming with animals, insects, plant diversity, mm-hmm. if you don't know what you're looking at, you don't recognize it. So having both Amy and Matt as mouthpieces on that and public learning over time, mm-hmm. what these things are and what to look for, really just increases the synergy of what we can do with helping biodiversity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I see the phone ringing. Listeners, if you want to call the program or email the program this hour as we talk about invasive species, biodiversity, our role, recognizing, you know, what might be pleasing but is not maybe great to have around here, and what's not that pleasing, like zebra mussels and
yes,
more.
Yes.
You can call the program. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. Let me grab a phone call, and then what we're going to do is we're going to go down a short list that listeners have kind of brought to us, and then we'll expand the list with our guests who are with us here. But first, I'll take Hal, who is calling from Livingston County. Hi, Hal. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I arrived to study our closest living relative, common chimpanzees, who share over 98% of our DNA, in 1970 in East Africa. And then you could look back on RAF air photos from the 40s where forests were continuous. But by the time I arrived, there were 4 billion of us humans on the planet who have, in a sense, invaded almost every habitat. And at the time, the national park, the Gombe National Park, was shrinking, and the numbers of chimpanzees who could travel around the area on their own, obviously, and interbreed were shrinking. Whereas now the chimpanzees are listed as endangered on the IUCN red list, and especially because of habitat destruction, which I was talking about, often the result of agricultural expansion. So when you have over 8 billion people on the planet, and the continent that is growing the fastest is Africa, many of our closest living relatives, such as the great apes, are extremely at risk, so that your children or grandchildren may never see one except pictures. So that's I really think you have to include humans as an invasive that is invading so many different habitats. And E.O. Wilson, the great biologist who died just recently, proposed that half of the planet could become conservation areas for fish as well as terrestrial organisms. And we could, instead of spreading out everywhere, try to limit our impact as invasive. So that's my pitch, Evan.
Hal, thank you for the phone call, Hal. Let me go around the table, Matt. What do you think?
Yeah, so I have given, in my time here as the terrestrial program manager, I've given just shy of about 200 public outreach events in the past few years. And I don't think I've ever given like a presentation or something like that where someone like Hal doesn't ask the question like, well, aren't humans like the worst invasive species? So this is something that we get asked about a lot of the time. I think Hal brings up some really good points. First of all, really cool experience, like studying like chimpanzees in Africa. But I think it's a little off the mark to consider humans to be an inherently invasive species. I think if you look at the records of, you know, many indigenous people around the world, they were a vital part of the ecosystems that they lived in for tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years. I think when we're thinking about, you know, are humans really the worst invasive species? I think many humans and kind of our society at large forces people to act like an invasive species, but I don't think humans necessarily are an invasive species. I think it's really a choice as to how we want to interact with the natural world that's around us.
Okay. Amy, what do you think?
Love a good philosophical question. I think humans are a step above other organisms in that we're really intelligent, we're really influential, and we move around a lot. You know, we just have a lot of influence. I think the way we talk about human influence almost sets us apart from the natural world, when I would like to include us as just part of the species assemblage here on Earth. But knowing our influence, knowing our impact, I think the next best thing we could do is just have some awareness about our influence. Yeah.
Okay, Whitney?
Working for New York State Parks, I have a pretty unique case where I'm often incorporating people into my projects because we focus on historic preservation, we focus on recreation, and we focus on stewardship. Those are our three main pillars. So we're always thinking about what will anthropogenic forces do to this area as we work on conservation and preservation. And so I would agree that humans have absolutely the most impact on any of our natural spaces in the world, but we're not going to work toward eradication the way that we would with some other species. So we need to think about it differently, as Amy and Matt said. I think that what they do with Finger Lakes Institute and any of the outreach our educators or myself do for New York State Parks is working on that invasive species, quote unquote, problem for humans. So we want people to interact better with the land. We want people to put their land into conservation easements. We want people to turn their lawns over to native plants to New York State. So there are lots of ways, little ways, that different groups are trying to work against that issue. But as long as we're keeping in mind anthropogenic forces as one of the things that we're always working with and working to accommodate in our projects, I think we are setting ourselves up better for the future.
Yeah, and Hal, just kind of listening to your point, what I would say is, if we want for a moment to envision a future where most species are ruined by nuclear war, you would then say, well, human beings were the worst. And you would be right. But that is not inevitable. That is not, sort of baked into what human beings are. There's a lot of different things that, a lot of different ways that this can go. Whereas a zebra mussel is not, you know, they're not like having talk shows and going like, you know, are we invasive? Should we be doing this? You know, they're more just, you know, being nefarious. And no, they're not even, I don't even know if they're nefarious. They're just doing their thing. And so what sets us apart is that we don't have to be destructive, Hal. And with the work that our guests are doing, that's helping people avoid the worst destructive tendencies. I do understand the point that you're raising. And I think it's better for us to be as self-aware as possible. That's partially why we're here. So thank you, Hal. I really appreciate that. And let me squeeze Jeff in Rochester in as well. Hello, Jeff.
Good afternoon.
Yep. Go ahead, sir. Yep.
I actually just had a red-winged blackbird fly by as I was parked on the ready to take the call. And their song here when they get back in our area every spring is one of my favorite things from the outside, from the outdoors. And it leads into my question about the invasive reed species that's taken over for the cattails, the one that grows to be like 12 feet tall and just grows at least three times as fast as the cattails. And I know the state has got its issues with it because I see them ripping it out of gullies and along the highways because of the sightline issues that it creates, just from a mechanical standpoint, not even talking about how it impacts the biodiversity. So can you tell me what is the type of reed that is, and how did it get here, and why is it so crazy in those in the gullies in the marshlands?
Jeff, thank you. Who wants to take this one?
Yeah, so the species that Jeff is talking about is called Phragmites. It's common name. It's kind of weird because we actually refer to it more by the scientific name than the common name. Mm-hmm. Common name is common reed, but it's usually referred to as Phragmites. Phragmites is one of our most widespread and difficult to remove and adaptable invasive species. If you're ever driving along a highway, we're based out of Geneva, so I drive from Rochester to Geneva to work every day along 490. If you see like just dead stands of really tall reeds, that's Phragmites. Mm-hmm. Phragmites is incredibly invasive. It's a very aggressive species, readily takes over pretty much any kind of habitat. It's supposed to be a wetland plant, but you can see it growing on roadsides and slopes, and even I've seen it once growing just like in the middle of the woods. It's one of our worst invasive species, and unfortunately, it's one of our worst, hardest to remove. Phragmites can handle a lot that we throw at it, whether that's herbicides, whether that's cutting, whether that's flooding. They could survive up to 6 feet of water, so and even fire as well. So
good gracious.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's very determined. Yeah. Whitney?
And I should also add that we do have another species that unfortunately gets called common reed sometimes that we do consider native to New York State, but what you are seeing as you drive along the highway is definitely not that.
Mm-hmm.
That's more what Matt's referring to.
Okay. Is there anything people could or should do about this particular one?
This is probably one of like two species I would say there's really nothing you could do about Phragmites. You probably don't have it growing in your yard. If you do, good luck. Unfortunately, this is what happens with a lot of invasive species, that the longer time that they have to sort of establish themselves and spread, the more and more difficult it becomes for us to remove them. So with, if we were able to deal with Phragmites, as soon as it was introduced, we wouldn't be having these problems like what Jeff was saying, where they're, invading gullies and stuff like that. But Phragmites, is all over the continental United States. It's all over Canada as well. It's not going anywhere anytime soon. Mm-hmm.
Jeff, thank you. In 2021, we had a conversation about the spongy moth. Now, I'm going to say this one time. It was known then as the gypsy moth, and you heard it everywhere. You saw it everywhere. It was a remarkable year for the spongy moth. But what we were told at the time was that we would probably see a lessening of that, there's an ebb and flow. So are they all gone now? Are spongy moths here at all? Are they completely gone? Did we send them somewhere else?
They're definitely still here.
They're
just lurking around in the background. Spongy moths have actually been in upstate New York since about the 1980s, I believe. They originally migrated here from Massachusetts, where they were first introduced, and they've been in the United States since the 1860s. So they've been here for quite some time. It was only in the latter half of the 20th century they really started to spread across the continent at a wider scale. Spongy moth has really cyclical populations, boom and busts. So when conditions are right, their populations will just sort of explode.
Like 3 years ago.
Yeah, like 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Kind of coincidentally, at the same time spongy moth was invading places like New York and Pennsylvania back in the 80s, there was this disease from Asia, this fungal disease that actually kept a lot of the spongy moth population in check. So even though it has been here for the past 40 years, we haven't really had any outbreaks because this fungal disease has been killing a lot of the spongy moth caterpillars before they can really boom. Now, the reason why we think, and this isn't, officially confirmed, this is kind of like the main thinking so far, that we had this big population explosion a couple years ago, was because we had a couple of springs in a row that were drier than normal, which means that this fungus that normally kills off a lot of the spongy moths wasn't able to establish itself, right? It's a fungus, it needs a lot of water to survive. And so without the fungus controlling its population, it was able to go wild.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible we'd still see some this summer, spongy moths?
Yeah, they're around. Their populations are just low.
Are we still instructed to squish them?
Yeah, if you want.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, squish them.
I would just add that for my work with state parks, a lot of what we're doing in our agency is egg mask counts. So that's how we know how to predict the population the following year. And so when we have a park where that boom cycle is really just extended, then we sort of make plans for, okay, what are we going to do to counteract this? You know, is this an area that is a significant or rare natural community that these are in? Do we need to consider that? Is this an area of oak trees, for example, who can stand to lose a set of leaves and then recover later in the year? So a lot of that thought process prior to the highest point in the boom and just trying to track that on our end.
Okay, so there we are with the spongy moth. Now, 2 years ago, we had a conversation about the spotted lanternfly. Reporter Gino Finelli wrote for City Magazine that it's an insect native to China, and we saw it moving especially toward the southern Finger Lakes up from Pennsylvania, and the concern, especially among grape growers, was that it could do real, real damage. I don't hear as much about that, and I want to be optimistic and say that, but I don't want to be naive. So where are we with the spotted lanternfly?
it is still spreading. It actually was just detected in Rochester at the very end of last year. So even though spotted lanternfly, I think, kind of had its moment a couple of years ago because that's when it was invading New York City. You know, so SNL like had a Weekend Update sketch on spotted lanternfly at the time. So I think, you know, when something happens in New York City, it's just going to reverberate like that much more. But no, we are still very much in the crosshairs of spotted lanternfly.
And it could do real damage, couldn't it?
Yeah, significant amounts of damage. You know, when we think about Finger Lakes region agriculture, you know, we think about grapevines, we think about apple trees, and spotted lanternfly loves to feed on both of those. So we are really, really concerned about the impact on our local agriculture.
What can we do?
So really the biggest thing, and this goes for all invasive species in general, mm-hmm. is that they have a tendency to spread really, really quickly and a lot faster than the three of us here in this room are able to keep on top of. We are really limited. You know, Amy and I at the Finger Lakes Prison, we cover a 17-county region. Rochester is just at the very western edge of that. We go all the way out to Syracuse and Binghamton and Ithaca. So we are constantly being pulled in every single direction.
Mm-hmm.
Point of that being is that if spotted lanternfly is going to invade a new area, we're probably not going to be the people who find it first. It's likely going to be like someone on the street who notices that. So
someone on a farm, someone.
Someone on mm-hmm. a farm, someone seeing it in their backyard, someone going to a parking lot and just seeing it there. Spotted lanternfly can live in a lot of different environments. So mm-hmm. it doesn't necessarily have to be like out in the country somewhere. It could be very happy here in, you know, downtown Rochester. So letting us know, reporting invasive species like spotted lanternfly as soon as you see them helps us eradicate them before their populations have a chance to get out of control.
Report to who?
The main tool that we use to track the spread of invasive species is a mobile app called IMAP Invasives. This allows citizen science app, and you can record information about invasive species that you find, and it gets uploaded into an online database that allows people like Amy, myself, and Whitney to track the spread of invasive species. So you can go hiking at, like, let's say Letchworth State Park, or I know you're more based in the Finger Lakes, Whitney, so like let's say like Taconic Park. You can find like a spotted lanternfly on the trail. You can record that with your phone, and then Whitney's going to be able to see that observation, and now she could go, hey, we have spotted lanternfly here, guys. Let's go and eradicate it.
Mm-hmm.
This is the time of the year for people to help. Everyone's going to Taconic. Everyone's going to Watkins Glen State Park. Everyone mm-hmm. is, I mean, it's a great time of year, but
yeah.
We all have a role, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Round goby.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Amy literally brightened up. She was like, it's aquatic.
That's right.
It's mine.
Yes, what about ugly, the round goby?
Ugly little fish that are not like all disappointing when you're fishing and you're like, oh, it's a goby.
Yeah. Well, unless it's your bait fish, I guess. But it is very, very frog-like in its face structure.
Yeah, I shouldn't body shame the goby, but it just is not a very attractive fish.
Mm-hmm,
okay.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the story here?
Yeah, round goby are benthic feeders. So that just means that they feed on the bottom kind of substrate or area of a water body. And they're really hungry and they're really prolific. So not only are they going to eat up all of the macroinvertebrates that are food sources for other organisms in that habitat, but they're going to aggressively feed on the eggs of other fish. So I think I'd like to address a kind of a misconception that goby are great as a food source for larger sport fish, when in reality, The goby might be feeding these adult populations of sport fish, but at the same time, the goby are feeding on those eggs, the potential new populations. So there's no replenishment of these mm-hmm. native fish populations.
How prevalent? How serious?
I think it's more prevalent sort of east of us.
Thousand Islands, we hear about that there.
Yeah, Hudson Valley, definitely, and the tributaries from that. But we have had an observation of round goby in Seneca Lake as of 2023.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So if you happen to be fishing and you catch one, don't throw it back?
Correct. Yep. Don't dispose of it in a water body.
yeah. Don't throw it back. What else do you want people to do about this? So, if you're listening and you're on a body of water and you see goby, or if you can confirm you see goby,
mm-hmm.
If you're on Keuka Lake and you find goby, I'm not saying you've seen it in Keuka Lake, but that mm-hmm. would be news, wouldn't it? You'd want to know.
Yes, please. Definitely. I think a piece of that I want to get at is the education. So before someone can observe and report the species, they need to know what they're looking for. And that's where Matt and I do a lot of education and outreach events for the PRISM, just teaching people what these species look like and how to identify them, and then where to identify them or report them.
Okay, so that's gobies. We're going to get back to their list in a moment. Let me grab a phone call from Pam in Newark. Hello, Pam. Go ahead.
Hi, Evan. I know there was concern about losing honeybees several years ago. And I wonder, are honeybees an invasive species? Because I think they were brought over here, and I think there was only the solitary bees here.
And you're flickering out, Pam, but I appreciate the question. So are honeybees technically an invasive species?
So honeybees are not from the United States. They're not one of our native New York bees by any stretch. So
we have native pollinators. They're not on that list.
Correct, okay. Correct. And pollinators, of course, ranging from anything like birds to bats to butterflies to bees to, you know, tiny, teeny, tiny little things you've never thought about before. But they are becoming an essential thing in agriculture. However, the bees that we often talk about worrying about becoming endangered or extinct are not honeybees. Those are our native bees that are very specialized. You know, you've got big bumblebees that can come out during rain when honeybees can't. And you've got little tiny bees that only come out at night. You've got some bees that pollinate lower parts of plants, some bees that only pollinate the tops of trees. So lots of niches over time, and invasive species are a big part of some of those niches disappearing. And with that, so then do our native bee species mm-hmm. that require it.
Okay. Anything you want people to do in this case?
I think the main reason we're here for Invasive Species Awareness Week is just to have people educate themselves and make sure that they're understanding what they're looking for. And it sounds like each one of these callers has had a very specific skill set in what they look at and what they take, you know, into their consideration. So if you're looking at red-winged blackbirds and you're spending time near wetlands, learn what your wetland invasive species are and then be able to report them on tools like IMAP Invasives, as Matt mentioned.
Thank you for that, Pam in Newark. Charlie called from his car to say that goby fish have been found in Keuka Lake. Now, that's his report. But, you know, not good to have goby in the Finger Lakes.
Yes. So I'll be on IMAP later confirming that observation.
There you go. And Mike in South Bristol writes in to say, we live on the backside of Bristol Mountain with 5 acres of woods. Jumping worms are feasting on our topsoil and stripping vital nutrients, killing plants and increasing erosion. What can we do to mitigate their impact? What is a jumping worm?
So the species he's describing can be a variety of different species, but usually they're just lumped together because they kind of look the same and they have similar impacts, and they're called Asian jumping worms. And they are increasingly becoming more and more widespread throughout our region. They really do jump. Like, we think of worms as, you know, these really slow moving, kind of clumsy animals. Look up a video of an Asian jumping worm and it looks like a worm having a seizure. Like, they'll literally like jump out of your hand. It's kind of wild. Unfortunately, with jumping worms, this kind of goes back to like my Fragmites answer. They're one of those species that, like, once they get established, they're really hard to get rid of. You know, how are you going to get rid of every worm in the soil, right? Like, they could go, you know, several feet below the surface. You'd essentially we need to scrape down to bedrock.
And there's no safe, again, I'm looking for something magical here, I realize. But yeah. like a treatment that will kill only them and nothing else and will not contaminate.
Unfortunately, not really. Go ahead, Whitney.
Oh, I was just going to add that I think jumping worm is one of those invasive species that by the time we realize it's a problem, it is far too widespread and falls into the category Matt's talking about, because not everyone is paying attention to the worms that exist in your yard until you start to see some of those, you know, organic nutrients in the top layer of your soil disappearing and erosion happening around your trees. Oof. So in state parks, we've worked with a couple of different researchers actually who are trying to do research on jumping worms, and they'll use mustard powder solutions to draw the worms out of the soil in some of their test areas to see what's living there. And they're working on ways to help us, if not eradicate, for the invasive species that are just so far spread, widespread, control or help support the native plants or native ecosystems on the opposite side. So we're talking about invasive species control here, but the other side that all of us work on is not just that, it's enhancing and supporting those native communities that are being degraded.
Mm-hmm. Good luck in South Bristol. David writes from the east side of Seneca Lake saying, it's said that the meek will inherit the earth, but Japanese knotweed will inherit the earth. True or false?
It's probably next to Phragmites. Like, it's the hardest invasive species to get rid of.
Japanese knotweed.
Japanese knotweed originally evolved to grow on volcanoes in Japan. So this is a species that can survive.
Resilient.
Very resilient. Literally can survive like lava. I've seen Japanese knotweed growing straight through asphalt before.
What does it look like? I'm going to look it up here.
It kind of superficially
looks like a bamboo, yeah.
Resembles bamboo. It has these kind of like big hand-sized circular leaves attached to like what looks like a bamboo stalk. Mm. Japanese knotweed also, because it grows in these really harsh environments, its roots can actually crack foundations of buildings. We actually have some Japanese knotweed growing right next to my apartment here in Rochester.
I thought you were going to say the WXXI building.
Could be.
Yeah, walk around the back and just tell us what you see.
And in the UK, actually, where Japanese knotweed is also invasive, banks won't give you a mortgage on your house if you actually have knotweed growing on your property.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But there's no...
There are methods to get rid of knotweed. You just have to be really careful, because even little itty-bitty pieces of the roots or that stalk of knotweed, if they break off and are left on the ground, they can actually grow into whole new plants by themselves. So really with knotweed, and with really all invasive species in general, removal should be focusing on the long term. You're not going to get rid of this species in a year. A combination of cutting it down, maybe putting a tarp over it. If you have access to things like herbicides, that could certainly help as well. But really, it's all of the above.
And this is Japanese knotweed is another one that, you know, may seem ubiquitous, but unlike Phragmites, you really, with those pieces breaking off, as Matt mentioned, you can help out by telling your neighbor who might have a patch, like, hey, maybe don't mow that at this time, and maybe bag it up and toss it or something, or leave it in a plastic bag to denature in the sun and get all gross and gooey before it spreads to my yard, sort of a deal. And I'll also venture, we've been working on a lot of grants together, our agency and Finger Lakes Prism. We partner. I think I've written at least a dozen grants with your organization. We've received more than half of them, and a bunch of them include Japanese knotweed that is in stream systems through our state parks that we're trying to keep from traveling downstream. So we're trying to be good neighbors to the watershed and to private residences by working together to make sure that some of these vectors, some of these ways that these invasive species can really spread on their own, are stopped. That's part of the control.
Mm-hmm.
David, thank you. I'm thinking about a root that can crack the foundation of a building. I would have thought that was just Lily of the Valley, which I can't get, like, just blowing up the front path near my house here. I go, you know, a foot down in the soil to get an entire root of the Lily of the Valley out, because I made the mistake years ago just ripping it out by the top, which was just fruitless.
Yeah.
So is that invasive? It feels invasive in my
opinion. So invasive species are kind of like a spectrum, where there's like some species like knotweed and Phragmites that are like, this is super duper invasive. There are some species, like we said before, like honeybees, they're not native, but they're providing actually like benefits to our economy by helping agriculture. Lily of the Valley kind of falls in between. Like, it is an invasive species, but like in terms of like, is it the worst invasive species? Like, sure. Definitely not.
Yeah,
definitely don't like seeing it around though. But
okay, gotcha. I mean, it looks nice.
Yeah,
I try to leave it in a small section. I'm like, just stay there, and it never listens. Dallas wants to know about cicadas. So it's like supposed to be a big cicada year. Is that an invasive species?
Cicadas are a native species.
Native.
We have tons of native cicadas here. And really, a lot of the cicadas that are popping up right now, they're popping up more in places like Illinois and Indiana and Kentucky, where they have a lot of those broods that are emerging this year. We have cicadas here as well. But yeah, they're native species. Good food for birds and stuff like that.
Yeah, Dallas, they're native and gross. from a listener, this is a text to my email. I don't know the listener's name, but says, Evan, I don't know if this is the right group to ask this question, but once the emerald ash borer has moved through an area, will the ash trees populate themselves from seeds? And the second part of the question is, do the ash borer actually move through an area because they don't have a food source? So what's the state of emerald ash borer?
I can take this question. It's a good question. So ash doesn't get attacked by EAB until it reaches a certain size, because emerald ash borer needs enough, you know, inner bark material to actually bore in through. So we are seeing a lot of ash regeneration, and thankfully these are one of the few tree species that deer don't love to like mow down as much as they do like things like oaks and stuff like that. Unfortunately, emerald ash borer can actually survive at really, really low population density. So they haven't, if we were kind of hoping for a little while that maybe they've killed enough ash that they wouldn't have anything else to eat anymore, but we're finding out now that as these younger ash trees are now maturing to the size that emerald ash borer can attack them, there is still emerald ash borer hanging around out there.
What can we do about emerald ash borer?
Again, another species, very widespread. We are in the midst of developing a really interesting program right now where we're trying to find lingering ash. These are ash trees that for some reason are maybe not immune to emerald ash borer, but they are dying slower than their neighbors around them. So that suggests that there's something about these ash trees that make them just that much more resistant to emerald ash borer. And there's a lot of really interesting research going on right now with the U.S. Forest Service and Cornell, where they are actually breeding ash trees to become more resistant and potentially immune to emerald ash borer in the future.
Whitney.
I just wanted to add, too, that is a push from DEC and other state agencies to not preemptively cut down your ash in case you have one of these more resistant trees that we can glean information from.
All right. We should have done 2 hours. We got to go fast. There's so many questions. Listener, I don't know the name. I apologize. Wants to know what we can do to remove zebra mussels if we have them in the water. Zebra mussels.
Zebra mussels are going to incur some pretty complicated management costs, but I think over and over again you hear us saying, oh, that's a species that we can't really eradicate at this time. Something I want to plug here is just prevention. So I think with zebra mussels, we can focus on prevention of spreading it to new water bodies. I like to think that eventually zebra mussels are going to reach carrying capacity in an area and they're going to kind of level off. That's my hope. In the meantime, let's try to prevent spreading them to water bodies that don't have zebra mussels.
How do we spread them even accidentally?
Zebra mussels reproduce through veligers, little larvae that can kind of attach themselves to the side of your watercraft. That's probably the most effective way for them to attach to us and kind of hitchhike. And then again, humans become the pathway. We become the vector, moving watercraft from water body to water body. That's kind of the risk of spreading them.
Okay. Steven wants to know if green algae is an invasive species.
Maybe depending on the species of algae, if we're talking about harmful algal blooms, that's another
story. I think
that's
probably more what he's talking about.
Sure, sure. So with a harmful algal bloom, there's basically just like a boom of one type of algae there that is like, you know, harmful to our human health. But in terms of invasive algae species, I'm not aware of any.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mike in Honeyway Falls says, for a lot of us, it's really hard to tell which plant is which. Is there a place we can send plant tissue samples for testing? Great show, by the way. You should mention the Doug Tallamy book, Nature's Best Hope.
Oh, great book. Yeah.
There you go. So I figured it'd be right up your alley. Thank you, Mike. It's a good question. Can we send plant tissue for testing anywhere?
So there aren't a lot of places that recommend you send plant tissue versus taking really great pictures. Mm. So you want pictures of leaves. You want pictures of the base of a plant. You want pictures of the plant as a whole, maybe its environment. Those are the kinds of pieces that we need to help you figure out what that is. You can use that IMAP invasive tool, upload as many pictures as you want to each of your observations. But plant tissue is usually only used for disease issues. And typically, folks like Amy, Matt, and myself are the ones who would send that in on someone's behalf. There are labs in Cornell that I've sent tissue to before to see if oak wilt is present. But that's typically not how we would just ID plants. And I will say, as a botanist, it's a little bit sad, but the apps on your phone are starting to be very accurate. So if you want to start taking photos using one of those apps, I at least trust them, most of them down to genus level. So that's a nice step.
All right. 20 seconds here. John Webster wants to know about ladybugs. Are we worried about ladybugs?
They're a non-native invasive species-ish, super widespread. Nothing really we could do about them at this point.
Okay. Last minute here. So, you know, Matt, when you guys reached out here, a big theme of this and understanding invasive species during Invasive Species Week is what we all can do. And we've talked a lot about what we can do. What do you want to leave with listeners here?
Yeah, so definitely, you know, when it comes to a lot of our invasive plant species and in New York, most of our terrestrial invasive species are either insects or plants, plant native species. That's like the easiest way we could deal with this. Despite all of the species we mentioned so far, there are lots of others out there, and there are already emerging invasive species that primarily is what I work with on a day-to-day basis. We plant native species, we can stop the invasion from the get-go, and we don't have to deal with any of the stuff that we're dealing with right now.
Okay.
I think kind of managing our own influence in the habitat, so that's play clean, go. Clean your outdoor equipment before you head to a new natural space, similar with your watercraft. Clean, drain, dry if you're moving from water body to water body.
Well said. And Whitney?
I would say do your homework. So, you know, if you have an area at home that you can make a difference, it counts. Do your homework. Figure out what is native to New York. Even people in the nursery trade sometimes won't know what you're looking for. We'll drive that demand. You can plant at home and trust your ecology specialists like ourselves.
We started with the silliness of that spider that everyone's talking about, but it turns out our listeners had dozens of questions, and we got through as many as we could. Please be educated, and I am so grateful for the expertise and the time of Whitney Carlton, Amy Slentz, Matt Gallo. Thank you all for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And from the whole team at Connections, it's Gary and Evan and Megan and Rob saying thanks for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on member-supported Public Radio.